Good evening and welcome to Tuesday Topics. And the issue that we're talking about this evening, the anniversary of its passage, is the Americans with Disabilities Act. It has now been in place for 15 years, though of course regulations took a while to get written, 2 or 3 years in fact. But for at least 12 years, the Americans with Disabilities Act has been around for good or ill. And there are a lot of opinions, both pro and con, with regard to the ADA, and I expect we'll hear lots of them this evening. But the ADA is also a moving target. That is, it doesn't simply sit still for analysis. There are changes that are taking place in the United States at this moment that may have a substantial impact on the ADA. And I speak in particular of, first, some of the cases that are about to come to the Supreme Court or just have. But I'm also speaking about the makeup of the Supreme Court itself. Ruth Bader Ginsburg has just resigned from the Supreme Court. I think that was who it was. Anyway, someone will correct me if I'm wrong. And she was a swing vote. And essentially, her replacement in the Supreme Court will have a lot to say about how things turn out. And there's also been a lot of discussion about the current Chief Justice stepping down because of ill health. So, having said that, what has the Americans with Disabilities Act meant to us? Has it been good? Has it been bad? Has it done good? Can it do more? If so, what?
Dave McElroy, Visalia, California. Good evening, all. And I'd like to start by saying I think that there has been good and bad in the ADA. For blind people, it's probably, in my opinion, been a wash at best, and maybe a loss at worst. If I may explain, first of all, I think the thing that the sighted public, and that's who we're really talking to or about, all they see are things like drive-up ATMs with Braille on. They don't understand, you know, what true discrimination means or can be. They don't understand the issue of reasonable accommodation. And I also think we have two sources against it. We have the sighted public, but we also have the rest of the disability community who, before ADA, has not enjoyed some of the rights and privileges that we have had as blind people. And so, in a way, I think we can expect that if it hasn't thus far, the ADA will reduce some of the things that we have and that we take for granted, like in, Social Security entitlement is a big one, I think. It's basically, I've heard others describe it as the Americans in Wheelchair Act, and I feel a little bit hesitant in making that statement because I do not begrudge any other disabled person. I don't. But I do have to be realistic about where it puts us as blind people, and I do think we are either at a wash or at a loss.
Your discussion of things like Social Security and a couple of the other things that you talked about are typical of some of the discussions that happen about the ADA. The ADA is a civil rights law, and I don't know why people want to tack other pieces of legislation onto it when they're analyzing the impact of the ADA. So, Mr. McElroy, explain, if you would.
Until ADA, the blind have virtually had carte blanche to get Social Security. That's just one example. That's the obvious example, so that's the one I'll use. We've had carte blanche. We go in and say, we're blind. You go to an eye doctor, the eye doctor says, he's blind. Questions answered, Social Security is provided, period. When you're talking about virtually any other disability that exists out there, they have to prove, beyond their disability, they have to prove that that disability prevents them from working. And the other issue of that, and the reason that also goes along with it, is that typically, and this I'll use California as an example of this, because California is an obvious example. Age of the blind, which was previous to Social Security, has been higher than aid to the other disabled. The SSI recipient in California who is blind will receive a higher check than those who are not. That is an inequality that, and I remember back in years past, Bob Acosta would say, as he was president of California Council of Blind at the time, and he would say, you know, we want other people to be brought up to us, not to be for us to be brought down to them. But I think there's room for the latter in this new conservative era that we find ourselves in. So I think there's a lot of reason for bringing these up.
Well, you haven't explained it to me. You've provided more detail about the Social Security situation. I don't disagree with you. Blind people certainly have an opportunity to collect more money than other people with disabilities. But you haven't, at least to this point, related your response to the Americans with Disabilities Act and indicated why you believe it has anything to do with the price of cheese with regard to Social Security.
Okay, the Americans with Disabilities Act basically puts all disabilities on an equal plane. They put all disabled on an equal plane. We have up to now been above that equal plane. And that's where I think the problem lies, Paul. We are no longer, we cannot say that we are more disabled than the other disabled that the ADA protects. And yet that's what we're asking the rest of society to do.
Well, again, I think we're doing chalk and cheese, and we're not going to spend a lot more time on this, though. But I think it's important for clarification purposes. As I see the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's a civil rights law, and it's intended to prevent discrimination. It's not intended to measure one's capacity for or relative merits for receiving any kind of amount of assistance. And in fact, assistance is one of the things that the ADA doesn't provide. And I would also take exception with your notion that the ADA puts all disabled people on an equal footing. I don't think it does, and I don't think it ever did. Even though the ADA is supposed to be a civil rights law, the fact is that, for example, its rules in the transportation area of Title II pretty clearly were written in such a way as to ensure that wheelchair lifts would end up on all buses, but because there was considered to be finite funding available, some of the transit needs of blind people kind of got shuffled off to the side in the writing of the ADA. And I think that's very real, but I think that it clearly means that the ADA speaks very differently to different populations. Title IV is primarily for the deaf and speech impaired. And even though there are telecommunications gains that would have been perfectly appropriate to include in the ADA for people who are blind, none of them were included. And so I continue to challenge both of your assertions, that is, that the ADA has anything to do with Social Security and that the ADA has very much to do with equality. All that the only sense in which it has to do with equality is it says that people with disabilities as a class should be treated in such a way that it cannot be proved that they're being discriminated against by the rest of society.
This is Joe Hartz from Mount Morris, Michigan. And one of the areas where it does dovetail, where the ADA does dovetail with Social Security and goes in line with what you're saying, Paul, is with the first cousin, Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, in that blind people have the right to equal and effective communications with their government and with public accommodations. And that includes providing material in accessible format. That is where I think not the ADA is deficient or 504 is deficient, because the regulations are pretty clear, but enforcement and compliance are not efficient. I've fought for years to get accessible information from everything from school districts to courts themselves under Title II of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I fought, as you know, to get information in accessible format in a timely manner from organizations of and for the blind, including rehabilitation entities, including my own, and I won't swear here, my own records.
Yep. And by the way, for those who don't know, there is probably no one in ACB who is as diligent as Joe is in keeping people informed of what's going on with the ADA. Joe has done a wonderful job of getting on all the lists that that give him access to really good information and has done an excellent job of sharing that information with the rest of us. And we all need to be grateful to him for that. My question to Joe, and perhaps to others, though, is if the ADA is as clear as it is, and I agree with Joe that it is, that accessible information is the right of people who are blind, that information in accessible formats must be provided, particularly by state and local government entities. I think Joe would agree that Title III isn't nearly as strong. But in Title II, there is a clear mandate for entities of state and local government, and that includes colleges and universities and school districts, by the way. So Joe's quite right. There is a mandate, a clear and unequivocal mandate for access to information for people who are blind. Why aren't we getting it? Because I think that deserves a little bit of time. Why aren't we getting it? And I'll have some things to say about why I think we aren't and about some experiences we've had here in Miami-Dade County, which I would dare to suggest is among the very best counties in the country at enforcing the ADA, if not the best. And I'm prepared to defend that as well. But why aren't we getting accessible information?
Brian here from Boston. Sorry, I'm going to be coming in and out because I'm working out some computer problems at the same time we're doing the show here this evening. I think one of the reasons that you're not seeing a great deal of change and provision of information is that the whole system is complaint-driven. And in fact, a single complaint doesn't rise to the level of causing entities to actually do something about it. You have to have a virtual class action in order to get somebody's attention. The number of times that I've complained to the Department of Justice on different issues would be an example of that, because they just add it to a list to see whether or not it's going to be significant enough for them to pursue on my behalf.
Well, I think that's the bad part, too. I mean, it seems like if it's complaint-driven, it seems like it's wrong. It seems like it ought to be proactive instead of reactive in that respect. I think ADA, I mean, civil rights of the disabled is as important as civil rights of any other group. But I think that's the way it should be. This is Gary Wood from Lansing, Michigan.
Hi, this is Joe Hartz again, and I'll concur with Brian and Gary somewhat. One of the problems that blind people in particular face is that we don't sue. I'll repeat, we don't sue. We go the settlement route, we go the complaint route, and we do not have case law like deaf people do who have similar issues in abundance on effective format issues. Also, particularly since the Bush administration, the Department of Justice itself isn't enforcing squat. I've got dozens of complaints on things ranging from ADA compliance over accessible voting to you name it, that don't even get a docket number, you know, that they don't even recognize. The Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Ed, I have 50 complaints in with them. It took me 6 months to get my daughter's school records in accessible format, you know, just to begin to start, and I had to keep lodging complaints. You know, people do not enforce it. And without going to court, without getting the case law, we don't have the precedent and the weight of law to do it. The final thing I'll say, and I really don't want to dominate, is that every entity, a state and local government, was to have conducted a self-evaluation, not to be confused with the transition plan, in which they put together the means, methods, and protocols for effective communication, among other things. And I'll tell you, folks, I haven't found one that's conducted, and I've asked more than 50 in writing.
Miami-Dade County did. And I'll share this with the group, and I'll make it open for comment because I think it's fascinating. Miami-Dade County did conduct that evaluation, and they did put together a communications program. And in fact, they threw together what amounted to a set of protocols for making accessible format materials available, and they actually set up a subdepartment of their ADA compliance office with the responsibility for providing that communication. It was extremely well publicized, both in the blindness area and in the general community. And that communications project ran for 4 years. Since my wife ran the program, I can tell you there were 3 requests for documents in 4 years. So we need to go beyond the fact that we don't sue. We also don't ask for documents. And why is that? Is it because we don't want to read them? Is it because we don't give a damn? There's got to be a reason. But in a community where people do it right, and to be really candid with you guys, I think this is a pretty widespread problem that doesn't just apply to accessible formats. I think it applies to a whole bunch of issues across the board. The idea that if you build it, they will come just doesn't seem to apply with blind people. And I don't understand it, but clearly, if we expect people to do the things that we need or want them to do, we're going to have to behave differently. Miami-Dade County doesn't have a communications project anymore because it was shut down, because there was no point in running a communications project when nobody wanted any.
I wonder if maybe blind people are either one extreme or the other, that the some blind people are extremely vocal on some of these things, and then other people will just, sit back and or some people might say roll over or something and let things happen, you know.
This is Lisa Hall, San Antonio, Texas. I think one of the things that I believe is that any entity, whether it be a college or a university or just a government, that needs to provide a material in accessible form. A lot of times they don't know who to contact. They're afraid that it would cost too much money to make available an alternative form. And not knowing exactly how to find certified Braille transcribers or those who are good at recording material in a format that we can use.
Yeah, I think you have a point, Lisa, but I don't know of very many colleges or universities who have outright refused to provide accommodations that blind people need. The truth is that as a person who runs a disabled student services department, I can tell you that in terms of Braille, which is the most expensive and the most difficult stuff to produce, the reality is that this semester I have had my first request that was justifiable and that was in fact carried through for real Braille access that I've had in the last 7 years. And I run a department with over 600 disabled students and over 50 blind people.
Paul, up here at UMass Boston, if you're a student with a disability, you're not allowed to interact directly in terms of your request for any form of accommodation with your professor. You're only allowed to ask for things through an official Disabled Student Services office, which adds to the time it takes to get an accommodation. gives the professor an example or an excuse for showing up at class without having gone through the preliminary steps to get material available in accessible format. Shows up with things in print and says, here, you can take this to the Disabled Student Services office. So I think many times the bureaucracies that are built up around implementing laws like the ADA are 90% of the problem. It's not the law itself. It's not the intent. It may not even be the courts. It's the joy of creating bureaucracies to support laws.
Brian, you're absolutely correct. And I think you raise an extremely valid point. I don't know why the National Alliance of Blind Students isn't all over that situation. I think there's a real injustice being done by people intervening in the center. I take precisely the opposite approach here at the college, and I think it's the right approach, in that I won't intervene to discuss an accommodation if a student and a professor have already worked something out, even if I don't think what the student and the professor have worked out is fair to the professor. I essentially let it go. One of the people who's on for the first time this evening is a gentleman from Halifax, Nova Scotia, whose name is Timothy Appleby, and I'd like to invite Tim in to perhaps provide us with a little bit of feedback on what our discussion of the ADA sounds like to a person from the Maritimes in Canada. So, Tim, why don't you come in and tell us a little bit about what's going on in Canada in comparison with what's going on here?
Well, for years, I think it was about 30 years, we've had an act in place for persons with disabilities across Canada. And ever since then, it's been changing, and it's ever changing now as we speak. And there have been some revisions to the Disabilities Act here in Canada, but no significant changes, really, except for the fact that they now made it law for all buildings and transportation services are able to be accessible.
The Canadian situation is a little different from the American in that, and see if you'd agree with this, Timothy, that for the most part, and we'll exempt buildings and transit, but for the most part, the Disability Act is really a statement of generalizations, and there's not really explicit law. Instead, there are lots of statements like people with disabilities ought to be treated, dot, dot, dot. One of the problems in Canada is because there aren't really clear regulations, it's very difficult for people to file complaints under the Disabilities Act. Would you agree with that, Tim?
Yes, I would, because in Canada we have had a lot of, even I have had a lot of discrimination against me years back when I was at a school which was originally a residential school, now turned right straight down to a level where all students have to go to a public school system just because we don't have a residential school anymore. It just went down to that. And, you know, if there were more optimistic people around, I think we would have still had a residential school here in the Maritime Provinces.
It's interesting to compare different countries and the approach that they've taken to disability law. In Australia, the government has the responsibility for developing and implementing solutions to problems when they are raised. So the Australian system is not nearly as complaint-driven as the American system. And it's much more powerful than the somewhat nebulous generalities that operate in Canada. In the UK, I think they're somewhere in between. They certainly do have a disability law, and it's certainly a lot less wishy-washy than what's going on in Canada. But it isn't nearly as government involving as the Australian approach is. Okay. ADA special format. We've talked some about Title II then. Title III of the ADA covers services essentially that need to be provided by non-government entities, and there's a list of them that I won't go into now. But Title III's requirements are not nearly so onerous as those under Title II, but there still are requirements. Does anyone have comments on Title III? How have businesses done at implementing the ADA? And ought we to be encouraged or discouraged by what's happened?
I think basically encouraged, at least insofar as Pam and I, for example, we're big going out to eaters, and you know, restaurants are really, maybe they don't, even if they, well, some of them are making the effort to get braille menus now more than they used to, but even more than that, we're finding people are genuinely happy to serve us and to accept our business. I'm not entirely sure how much of that has to do with the law and how much of it just has to do with the fact that we're willing to spend money and go into their establishments. I don't know what the answer is to that. Certainly over the years, nobody has ever said, oh, gee, Title IV says I have to, Title III ADA says I have to do this. Sometimes it's mentioned, but not very often. Since we don't have a way of telling whether or not these things would have happened without the law. Now, we don't have, we can only surmise. But I think overall, in basic terms, I think as we blind are concerned in this country, I think that's probably been our best.
This is Timothy Appleby once again from Halifax. Restaurants in Canada, some of the restaurants, especially the smaller ones, don't have the capabilities of having braille menus or large print menus. It's very difficult. I was trying to get into a business and doing that, but failed because of that situation.
It's interesting. One of the peculiarities of the Americans with Disabilities Act is there is specific language in the regulation that indicates that it is not necessary for restaurants to braille menus for people with disability, for people who are blind. If they are prepared to find an alternative way of meeting the needs of assuring that the customer receives equitable service, they're not required to braille menus. What that usually means is that it's construed that they need to read people menus. But the fact is that I'm sure, like most of you, my experience the other night in a restaurant was pretty typical. Well, this is the first time I've been here. What do you have on your menu? Well, what do you want? So, essentially, I'm seldom given the choice of truly making a fully fledged choice. Now, we are entirely within our rights, and so was I, to say to the waiter or waitress, look, I want to know what you have so I can make an informed decision about what I want to eat. And the truth is that had I said that, I think she would have just walked away and I would have ended up walking out. But it's a problem because most of us are not prepared to demand what our rights are. Instead, we will accept what we're given.
I do think that we accept what we're given. I've made a decision myself that whenever I go into a restaurant, I ask first for their braille menu, taking an attitude that, of course, they're going to have one. And there have been many times that I'm in a restaurant where I know there's a braille menu and they say they don't have one, so I have to insist. And on those occasions where they say they don't have a braille menu and I don't know to the contrary, I said, well, I'd love to speak with your manager. And I get the manager to come out to the table and explain to them the value of a braille menu and give them a business card and said I'd be more than happy to talk to them and direct them to a service that can provide that to them. It does not work most of the time. That is, I give the card and I never get a call back. There are rare occasions where it does. Here in Watertown, where I live, we have 80-some-odd restaurants, and I know that number to be a real one because we put together an accessible restaurant guide every year. And we include in that survey which restaurants have different means of accommodation. And it, out of 80-some-odd restaurants in a city with a large blind population. This is the home of Perkins School for the Blind and very near the Carroll Center for the Blind and the Mass Association for the Blind, etc. Nonetheless, only 5 out of 80 restaurants have Braille menus.
Probably a lot of places probably can't afford to have Braille menus, and it isn't quite so bad if you can have someone who's willing to read, a waitress or who's willing to read what's on the menu. And I don't like someone saying, what do you want? I mean, I like to know what's available. I mean, a lot of times I'll go into a restaurant and I, with the idea of knowing what I want, like tonight I went to a pizza place and I knew what kind of pizza I wanted, so we got that. But some nights I do, but sometimes maybe I want to know what else they got.
Yeah, it does seem kind of localized, and I'm really surprised at what you say, Brian. Given Watertown, given its population, that really surprised me, because here in Visalia, where Pam and I are truly the only two blind people that people see around, and yes, there are others, but they're either infirmed or they're just not around. I mean, it just seems like in this town of 100,000, Pam and I are the ones that are out there. And yet I can count right now, as we sit here, 4 restaurants that have Braille menus. There might even be more. Part of it is, I know we happen to have, no, it's, maybe it is 5. Let's see. Part of the reason for that, we happen to have in the city a local transcriber group, and they've been here for years. They're all quite elderly now, but one of them went into one of the places that I'd never even, and they said, oh, we you guys need a Braille menu, and we'll do it for you for free. And they said, sure. And so, now Pam and I go into that establishment. It's not one we go into regularly. It's one of the pricier ones, but it does seem to be hit and miss. And I don't know that. It's interesting. Has ADA really made a difference one way or the other? I don't know. I think the wider prevalence of Braille or the ability to create Braille has probably done as much to bring this about as the law itself, because I don't think the average John Q. public knows whether they're obeying the law or not. They just know they either have or don't have Braille menus. And I don't know if that's a good thing, but that's what I see it from out in the sticks.
And again, the ADA doesn't require it. In fact, it specifically mentions that it's not required. So the availability of Braille menus one way or the other isn't an aspect of the ADA in that regard, its success or lack of success. Paul, can you think of some other examples of areas where other people might have thought of it as a reasonable accommodation that's explicitly excluded by the ADA, like Braille menus?
There was an agreement in advance of the signing of the ADA that that in order to be sure that we could get the law passed that would assure that lift-equipped buses would be deployed on virtually all networks, there was a kind of a clear backing away from recognizing and validating some of the specific transit rights of people who are blind or visually impaired. So under those, there wasn't very much discussion of stop calling or of the use of technology to meet that kind of goal. And I guess the other thing that I would at least put on the table as another example of it, Brian, is the fairly explicit limitation of Title IV to people who are deaf, whereas the issues are exactly the same, and perhaps the discrimination could be proven virtually as sufficient for people who are blind under the ADA, but we're simply not at a place where that's being enforced. And I had actually thought of a third example, but it's out of my head right now. So, but those are some other examples. It isn't only Braille menus. On the other hand, people say that blind people got nothing. I think blind people got an awful lot out of Title II if they'll only make up their minds to ask for it. The fact is, if they don't ask for it, blind people won't get any of the things they have a right to in Title II.
When it comes to Title III, I agree and I disagree somewhat with Paul on effective communications. It depends on the length, durations, and importance of the message sent. And what the regulations state is when it is of medical, financial, legal, or educational significance, then material must be delivered in an alternate format. And that goes to issues like bills, accessible billing. That goes to issues well beyond the reading of a Braille menu. It goes to Title III access to attorneys, for example, and our own legal documents through those law firms. It goes to financial documents of public entities that are Title III entities that are publicly available, and so on and so forth. So it depends upon the importance. And to the issue of not asking, I think a lot of that goes to the nature of the medium. Many blind people don't know their rights because of how it's distributed. How many have even read the ADA or even take the time to understand it or been exposed to it? We aren't exposed to it in rehabilitation programs. There's very little education on it in most programs. People, frankly, don't know their rights. And I think also as a class, in a present company accepted, we are a pretty passive lot.
Joe, I sort of agree with you and disagree with you. I think you're absolutely right that I understated the degree to which Title III entities are obligated to provide information in accessible formats. And I guess the reason that I did is I know of very few entities who would say they're providing the bills that they provide or that they're providing the accessibility they're supposed to because of the ADA. And there are lots of other laws that get cited, but I don't think the ADA is one of them. I think, again, nobody's really tested the cases as they have with people who are deaf. There have been innumerable suits by people who are deaf who are absolutely outraged at the degree to which they'll come into a hospital emergency room and really will have no opportunity to describe their symptoms until a doctor turns up. And then when a doctor turns up, the interpreter's not there. And so the reality is that effective communication doesn't happen. But deaf people have filed innumerable suits with regard to the inappropriate treatment they've received as a result of their deafness. There's a fascinating housing study that came out yesterday that demonstrates that blind and deaf folks are discriminated against pretty seriously in terms of both low-income Section 8 and regular-income housing. And that study is interesting. It was actually done in Chicago. Again, under Title III, people simply haven't been asking for their rights. Joe, I don't know what the right answer with regard to training is, and I'd certainly be open to suggestions from folks. I know Brian, who's been to conventions a lot, will I'm sure concur with me that in the period from 1990 to 1996 or so, the ACB was actively involved in training. We encouraged affiliates to do training. We set up contacts with DibTACs and a whole range of other things. For those who don't know, DibTACs is the name given to a group of 10 entities who were about to be pulled in who were supposed to provide technical assistance support and even throw away glass. But anyway, the fact is that that for the most part, those kinds of accommodations aren't happening either, and it's kind of disconcerting and worrying.
I think one of the reasons why blind people don't file more complaints is the very fact that it's paperwork oriented, and that we are very much an oral kind of community, an oral tradition, and that simply doesn't cut it when it comes to filing complaints. Filing complaints means
paperwork. Filing complaints means documenting what took place. Anecdotal stories don't quite cut the mustard when it comes to that process. And we're simply not prepared to take the effort to do that. I would argue that the effort is a little bit more significant for a blind person to go through that whole complaint process than it is for otherwise physically disabled person. And I could be wrong, but I really do think that at least discourages us from doing it. We, as a community, have gotten along the way we have up to this point, I think we generally speaking believe, because we're reasonable about our requests and we're flexible about what we will accept in terms of accommodation. So we think we get more flies with honey than with vinegar. I think, Joe, you're correct that we should be filing more complaints. We should be really encouraging a culture where we do that. But it is a little bit hard on me because I'm just not the kind of person who spends my time doing that. Rather than filing a complaint against an establishment, when there's two or more establishments, I'll go to the one that accommodates me and take my business away from the one that doesn't. I have filed complaints primarily against cab companies for discrimination as a guide dog user, and restaurants under the same circumstance. I haven't had a need to file elsewhere, although I've had the need in dealing with my health care provider to be very hard-nosed about what I would accept and achieve my protest by refusing to leave the office until I'm accommodated. But it nonetheless, I think, is a matter of the culture, if you will, of blindness that makes for part of that situation.
I do all my stuff by email. And my only request for information in accessible format, including related to my complaints, are via email. Yet for years, the Department of Justice would not accept email complaints. Until yours truly came down and handed about six of them to him in person in Washington and pointed out that this was a discriminatory pattern and practice of themselves, which was also pointed out by the National Council on Disabilities. The other good thing about email is I save them, and that is documentation of your requests and of the responses or lack of responses. Now, getting people to look at that documentation and act upon it is another thing. I'm going to throw out something here, and we'll shut up on it, but I think that there's another problem that's a hot potato, and that is when organizations of and for the blind, both, in my experience, do not remit information in accessible format in a timely manner, and often retaliate against individuals. We have to set the model for what others do, or we're doomed in this front. And I am accepting present company in this regard.
I think it's an interesting issue. We would be regarded as Title III entities, and clearly we have some responsibility to provide that information, and sometimes we haven't in the past done a good job. I think we've built in a system that should ensure that it happens more easily now than it has in the past. And clearly you were partly responsible for making that happen because you didn't quit. And it's, regardless of what we think of your approaches and your tactics, the fact is, A, you were successful, and B, your tactics worked, and C, in principle, and probably to a large degree in practice, you're absolutely right in having gone for what you had every legal right to expect. Is there another way to look at the ADA that perhaps allows us to see some things that we don't normally notice? We've all been very negative, or for the most part have been very negative about the Americans with Disabilities Act. And I want to throw out for people's discussion two major impacts that I think the ADA has had. I think that one of the biggest changes that the ADA has wrought is to absolutely turn the tables on between the society and the relationship with people with disabilities. Prior to the passage of the ADA, particularly in the private sector, if those of us who were disabled needed help in a public entity under Title III, essentially we would go there and we would get down on our knees and we would grovel and we would say, you know, I'll take an appointment for assistance from someone in your store 5 months and 2 weeks from tomorrow, and thank you very much, you're so kind. With the ADA, I think disabled people are beginning to recognize that they do have rights, and I'm not sure that they really did believe that those rights existed. And so I think we are beginning to see the emergence, albeit slowly and albeit tentatively, of a culture that truly believes that it has a right to inclusion in all aspects of society. I don't think we believe that at all as the blindness community prior to the implementing of the ADA.
It allowed us to see that we really do have rights, maybe that we've always had rights, but we just haven't forced the implementation. But I think the Americans with Disabilities Act raised the bar, helped us realize that we can do that now.
I would also suggest that even those near and dear to me didn't ever issue the words 508. They never spoke of 508. They never spoke of the Rehab Act, etc., etc. But ADA has almost become a household word, at least in the people that I'm in contact with. So there's a PR value, if you will, both from the perspective of the person with disability and the general public, where there is an assumption that that person with a disability has some rights, even if they don't quite understand what it is, that you can use the letters ADA and people don't get glassy-eyed over it. They really do understand that this is that civil rights thing for persons with disabilities, and that comes to our aid. We don't have to specify what chapter and verse, we just save the letters.
My second issue, probably the part of the ADA that's been most successful, and probably the reason is because there have been people out there selling it, has been the provision of training under the ADA. When the ADA was first implemented, there were bunches and bunches of Title III people who were lining up by the door to know what it is they could do and how they could help. And we actually put together on our campus a course in sequences that we can't count anymore, and for that and a variety of other reasons, we don't do it anymore. But the whole point of all of the programs that have gotten implemented, I think the core and most valuable one is the requirement, particularly under Title II, that training happen for staff, that training happen for the wider community, and that training happens for people with disabilities. I would argue that the least successful of those three has in fact been the training of people with disabilities, that there is a much more widespread understanding and acceptance of the idea of civil rights for people with disabilities. And I think that 20 or 30 years from now, the attitudes of the people who've been trained under the ADA now will be substantially different. And I think we are going to reach a quantum point in the history of our country where disabled people will never be fully accepted, but where the need to validate, uphold, and deal with people with disabilities in a fair and equitable way, I think is really being pounded home by a lot of the training that's happening all over the country. So those are my two really positive takes on the ADA.
I'm very positive about the ADA as a law. My only negative comments are no, any law is only as good as its enforcement. You aptly point out one of the positive things is training and technical assistance, which is ample. But I feel that that has lagged. You know, there was a lot of initial spurts and actions on that, including here in the state of Michigan at the regulatory deadline in 92. And I'm talking about Title II entities, but also a big open door to places of public accommodations. Yet over the years, the ADA coordinators have changed, this, that has changed, the facilitation has changed, and the training has changed. The ADA was not, like every civil rights law, not envisioned as a static thing in time. But the ultimate goal is to promote our integration into the mainstream of every facet of American life. So I totally agree with you that one of the benefits was to have this type of training, but I feel that in practice has not been consistent around the country. And I think the emphasis that you brought up at the beginning of the show, that the ADA is a civil rights law, it is lost, and sometimes even lost, in some of the requests that I make for reasonable accommodation. It isn't the piece of paper itself. It's the right to access, on equal terms that anyone else would have. It isn't a wheelchair ramp in itself. It's the right to get into the bloody establishment or whatever. You know, so the goal is equal opportunity, which is a fundamental civil right.
We've really only scratched the surface this week with some of the issues that I think are still out there. What we have managed to establish is that there are some good things about the ADA. There are certainly some bad and frustrating things about the ADA. Let's go around the group for final comments that you might have on what will turn out to be part one of our ADA program.
Hi, it's Debbie Hazelton. And I'm sorry that I wasn't here much of this evening. The ADA is such a mixed bag, and I think that's a good idea, Paul, to have another week on it. You know, on the surface, I would agree that there are many ways in which people with disabilities do have more rights. Perhaps some people with disabilities perceive more rights. I mean, I know that it probably has helped me to stand up for myself, assert myself, although I think I was doing that before ADA, but maybe given clarity, and also clarity at times as to what doesn't come under the ADA. I also think that there are a lot of loopholes, and I remember one time reading, that the reason ADA really came into being was because the purpose of it was to make more taxpayers out of us. It wasn't so much about rights. It was about getting more of us to work and paying taxes. I remember when I read that thinking, gosh, that does make sense, but it's not about rights here. What about rights? What about this lack of discrimination? So I think there are many faces to it, and I think training is important. A lot of times people who are being trained don't get it. I think it's a good thing. I think we have a long way to go.
I would give the ADA more than a passing grade. I think it has improved things, even if much of the improvement has proven to be symbolic. Until such time as people feel what they have is threatened, that they're going to be slow at pursuing this, that in fact it's not really until we feel threatened that we stand up and say enough is enough, and we didn't have enough new feeling of entitlement through the ADA, that once we start to have things like judicial reviews that result in a diminishing of the potential of the ADA, that until we started feeling like that was something we accepted and experienced on a regular basis, you're not going to get too excited about it. So I hope we can rile up the troops a bit over the process of selecting judges and dealing with elected officials and the like as they write regulations to implement the ADA. that we can get excited enough about it before we're in a crisis mode.
The ADA is a work in progress, and I think that it's an ongoing process.
This is Rachel in Orlando, and I'll get one comment in here. I've kind of been sitting back listening intently to people who know a lot more about this than I do, and that probably is an example of what a lot of people are in the situation of at this point. ADA is a great thing, but I think we have a long way to go, and it's certainly in our best interest to learn as much about that as we can, learn what our rights are, learn and be able to take full advantage of what the ADA is supposed to be able to do.
As Joni Mitchell said, you don't always know what you got until it's gone, and the ADA is under severe threat and has been, actually, for the last 5 years by various court rulings. I happen to have Jeffrey Sutton in my own Circuit Court of Appeals, and for people who follow case law, that ain't a good thing. I would like to take this point, just as a point of personal privilege, to thank you, Paul, very much, and to thank you, Brian, very much, for your attempts to make ACB reasonably accommodate yours truly. And I do mean that sincerely.
Well, thanks, Joe. I know Brian would join me in welcoming your appreciation. And we appreciate your being here, and we hope very much that you'll be here next week. We have a lot to discuss next week, the future of the ADA, and in a very real sense, the future of civil rights for people with disabilities is up for grabs right now. And I think we're very much at a crossroads. And where we proceed in the next year or two will, I think, have a significant impact on the degree to which we will ever create a level playing field for people who are blind in the United States. On behalf of our recorder, Rachel Bader, our editor, Dave Williams, the creator of the software that we're using this evening, George Bies, I'd like to thank everyone for tuning into this program on the ADA. Thank you very much for joining us. Thanks to those who participated in our discussion this evening. And remember, stay tuned to ACB Radio, connecting the blind community. Good night. We're at a crossroads now where the rights of people with disabilities may be severely threatened and where the Americans with Disabilities Act may be in serious jeopardy of disappearing. Join us to find out what you can do to protect the ADA and why it is that the ADA is now in such serious trouble. So, tune in to Tuesday Topics and remember to listen to ACB Radio, connecting the blind community.